everyone, and welcome to Two Crickets in a Thorn Tree. We're back after a short hiatus, and now we're going to be enthralling you with tales of wonder and mystery from South Africa and around the world. I'm joined, of course, by my co-host, Gabriel Krauser.
How's it?
So let's get started right away. Before I start, sorry, one more thing that we need to talk about. We are now actually on Apple Podcasts, so please go listen to us there. And if you are interested in hearing us on another platform, please send an email to nicholas@irr.org.za, and I'll try to get us on that platform. We want to know where our listeners are, so that would be much appreciated. Anyway, let's go ahead. Gabriel, why don't you start us off here? So there's been a riot in Joburg.
Yeah. Little context of where we are in the studio. We're sort of just west of the Central Business District. It's a Friday afternoon, and it's been a long week, so we've poured ourselves a whiskey.
Yes, to enhance the conversation.
And process this this madness. To me, just watching these videos.
Well, let's talk very briefly about what exactly happened. Yeah. So the cops and the Joburg Metro Police, they went into the city of Joburg. They do this every now and again. It's part of Mashaba's sort of clean up the CBD program. And they were there primarily, they said, to confiscate counterfeit goods that were being sold by the mostly foreign-owned businesses there, although, of course, not only. Mm-hmm. During this raid, there was a lot of pushback from the people in the area, and it turned into a display of civic violence where people were throwing stones at police and yalas, and the cops were basically forced to leave the area, in their words, to prevent a bloodbath, as they said. Mm-hmm. It was very nasty scenes, lots of dramatic footage on social media of like 1,000 people pelting police trucks, armored trucks, with rocks. Very dramatic stuff. So anyway, Gabriel, tell us.
Yeah, so to me it looks like a dream or a kind of nightmare or fantasy that I'd once been told about turning into reality just as it had been predicted. There's a Shwami, a sort of religious leader, man of many races who's traveled many parts of the world, but once upon a time was just a desperate teenager, and my mom saved him from a dark situation, and so he's been a friend of the family ever since. And because of all the worlds he moves through, he has often provided me with insights that that many sort of bourgeois suburban elites overlook. And one of them is, he said, people, foreign nationals, black African foreign nationals living in South Africa, have really been taking a beating, literally.
Yes, from
the cops.
Our very professional and very delicate Metro Police, they're very famous for that sort of behavior.
And he said they've been taking it, and one day they're going to stop taking it. And what it'll look like is hundreds or thousands of people coming out into the street with rocks, and they will drive the police away. And that's exactly what I saw. And what he foretold the next thing to be was a backlash from the cops. And there's some reason to think that that is already on the police mind. The one view is...
Well, that was one of the stories behind Marikana, wasn't it? That some cops had been killed by the strikers in the days before. And so some of the violence that came out from the cops was from a desire to basically take vengeance.
Yeah. And just to give some context, this is all happening on Jeppe Street, now known as recently changed to Rahima Musa Street. And Jeppe Street is in a part of the CBD, sort of south of the railway tracks, how would you put it, west of Mabaneng, east of the Turbine Hall and the Standard Bank and the FNB Bank City. It's a part of the city that's known to locals as Little Addis Ababa, or Little Addis, because of the high ratio of Ethiopians that live there. So the one image you see is shot from a balcony somewhere up above Jeppe Street, Musa Street. It really does look like hundreds, if not thousands, of people streaming along and pelting this police vehicle with rocks and driving it away.
Yeah, completely caught up in the sort of battle lust.
Yeah, and there's this rigorous. There doesn't seem to be a chant, but the shouts and the anger and the words that are being said seem to have a cadence to them, a kind of doom doom thumping cadence, and the rocks pelting against it, and the police desperately getting into the Nyalas and then rushing away. And then there's a second bit of footage, which is from inside one of the police stations, and you see that none of them look injured, but they're panting and wide-eyed, and their pupils are fully dilated, and some of the more senior members perhaps are sort of saying well done, and then you hear the line, "We'll be back."
Yeah,
we will be back. And the next round is, if they come back, is a bit of gunshots. And the thing to worry about, at least the thing that this Swami told me to worry about years ago, was when rocks are replaced with guns and bullets. And to use a bit of stereotyping, one might think that the foreign nationals that come from Malawi and Ethiopia, desperately fleeing fairly oppressive regimes with nothing to their names other than their shoes, if they're lucky still under the soles of their feet, have to resort to rocks.
No,
but
yeah,
we
no
know
strong association with violence and the stereotypes about those groups.
But we know that there are other foreign national groups that come from countries where the violence is not just state-oriented. Countries like the Democratic Republic of Congo, so-called, and Nigeria, where the state has for so long been so atrophied, and Somalia too. The state itself, its supposed monopoly on force, has been so curtailed for so long that there have been real establishments of fiefdoms. Fiefdom is, we like to think of sort of ESCOM as a fiefdom, or the Gupta Shabin as a fiefdom, but a real fiefdom is backed by violence that's not in the background, it's in your face.
So when you're you come from a rural area of Nigeria, or maybe even a suburb of Lagos, and you move to the CBD, there isn't necessarily that much difference. You're just moving from under the control of one local warlord to one local gang.
Yeah, and if you have local gangs retaliating against the cops, then you begin a cycle of violence that has played out in America in the 30s, in Germany for certain in the 30s, in various parts of the world that doesn't bode well. Little context, if I can give it.
Yeah, sure.
So I live in Yeovil, basically. I live next to Yeovil. I grew up in Yeovil. And Yeovil has long been a safe haven for foreigners. The first time I remember xenophobic attacks at scale was in 2008. There had been attacks before, but there was really this nationwide sort of outbreak.
That was when
you
really saw like lines of people fleeing the townships and that sort of thing.
And where did a lot of people come to? They came to Yeovil for the simple reason that the density of foreign nationals in Yeovil is already so high that you don't need to barricade yourself, really. You don't really need to take up arms.
Yeah, you're
you
not isolated
there.
You're amongst people.
And you can be amongst other
side.
People. And no one's going to take a chance coming against you. And so it's totally sort of like an island of calm. Yeovil had an interesting incident a month ago that I'm not sure if I've spoken about on the show.
You've spoken about it on one of our shows. I don't know if it was this one.
But just to give a very brief recap, there was a man was shot. He was Zulu. This matters for the story. His immediate family and friends had a kind of ceremony in Yeovil on the streets and in the park to commemorate him, and they shot bullets into the air, some kind of spiritual ritual. The police took umbrage with this. It's against the law to openly fire bullets into the air. There was some kind of exchange.
And also not particularly safe.
Not very safe at all. Not a good idea. I mean, there was some exchange of words. Please put your guns down. Disarm yourself. We're going to arrest you. There was no, we're not going to do that. And then there was an exchange of fire, in the process of which the brother of the deceased was himself shot dead. And after that, for a week, Yeovil went into lockdown. The streets were barricaded. There were burning tires up and down. And as I've said, Yeovil has been this bizarrely tranquil part of South Africa. There's never been a public protest.
Yeah, everyone sort
in
of
Yeovil
associates it with crime and murder and that sort of thing. But in this particular way, it was calmer.
Yeah. And And that changed. And after 6 o'clock, if one was driving around, one saw literally no one on the streets. It was unearthly. And the worry was that you're going around and either the Zulu mob is going to catch you or the police are going to catch you or ask you tough questions. And on the Friday, sort of heard reports from Orange Farm, which is very far away, saying, oh, have you heard the Zulus are coming to Yeovil? The Zulus are coming to Yeovil. And about 100 Zulus came up to Yeovil from the heartlands of KZN. To have another funeral now for the brother who'd been shot dead. And they marched up and down the streets themselves, shooting bullets in the air, but this time en masse. And this time the police stood by and watched quietly.
Which is, to be fair, more what the South African police are known for.
This is what the police are known for. And I must say, as a resident or neighbor, I was relieved.
In this case, yes.
In this case, that there wasn't a bloodbath. But it does speak to a de facto surrender of state power. Because why? Because the police are in a very difficult situation. And also because some police are not really fit for the job.
Yeah, I believe it's because our police have such low morale. That they're just not willing to get into. I mean, we all have stories of sort of the police running away at the first sign of trouble and then ordinary people having to deal with the mess.
Yeah, or private security. But these are areas where there is no private security, where people are their own private security. And so town, little Addis, this is much larger in scale, really. And it doesn't bode well. And I think it speaks to something that the Institute of Race Relations often has in mind, particularly under Frans Grenier, who speaks to scenario planning. And he has basically four scenarios that he sees the country one being of which able is, to go to down.
One of which is the fragmentation scenario, which looks a lot like these scenes that we're seeing now, where the power of the state evaporates as it runs out of resources, as it runs out of capacity. And in its place arise sort of local warlords and sort of managers and gang leaders and that sort of thing who take over and become the de facto state. So we essentially turn into a hyper-federalized society.
And, you know, if you go just the other side of – if you go sort of just a little bit further down Louis Buerta from Yeovil, from town through Yeovil, shortly afterwards, you have a massive new development to create a new police kind of barracks, and then just after that, you have Norwood, and the Norwood situation to me is comic actually, because you have a golf course upon which we used to have the $1 million challenge. It was one of the premier golfing events. It looked like if South Africa just played its cards right, we might elevate ourselves to master status, which comes with a lot of tourism and prestige and this kind of stuff. And instead, we've gone the other way, and a lot of the land has been ceded in order to build a new grand gated community with the golf course as a basic sort of green lung park that the members have access to. And these apartments are, you can see from the billboards and from the advertisements, are being sold for millions and millions, brand new, plush, high quality stuff. And what is the biggest advertisement? We have generators, so you don't have to worry about load shedding. It's its own little fiefdom.
Yes.
The standard idea that the state provides electricity is not there.
So this is the other part of the fragmentation thesis, is that the middle class won't just disappear. It will retreat into enclaves.
Mm-hmm. And so Danefern is a future, perhaps, for more and more people. Stain City is a future, perhaps, for more and more people. But people who can't afford...
There was a place that France and I saw in the Eastern Cape, which literally, it was a kind of gated community, except it literally had a moat around it.
Yeah. So the moats, and if you go into the Free State, you see a lot of moats too around the farms. So it's medieval. And Monte Cassino, this sort of idea of South Africa being sort of vast, agrarian, rural place with little...
sort of economically dead wastelands punctuated by these little enclaves of relative prosperity.
Walled in and autarkic in the sense that they totally take care of themselves.
Very interesting, on a slight side note here, a lot of historians believe that the feudal system, as kind of commonly understood, although it's a very contentious term amongst medieval historians, was established precisely in that same way, that the sort of higher-up unitary state of Charlemagne's empire wasn't able to enforce security on the ground, and so people went to local leaders, and the whole thing disintegrated into this very localized, autonomous collection of people.
And you see the same thing in China in the start of the 20th century. Exactly, it really starts to fall apart, and then you have decades of feudalism and warlords. And out of that, and the problem with that is that once you get there, if a unifying force is going to come back and rein the whole thing back in once more, it might be not of the sort that you like.
And there's also a lot of violence in that process itself, because the sort of some people are tempted to think of this as actually a kind of liberating thing, because it means that you have someone you can deal with locally. Mm. You know, you can free yourself from a lot of the very
domestic
nasty
politics face to face. You know your little mayor.
And that's in some ways it is better. There probably would be a little bit of a economic opportunity in such an environment, because you know you won't have the state enforcing BEE regulations, because you'll be making a deal with your local warlord who just needs maybe a much smaller payoff. But there's usually violence between the different
across the factions,
yes.
And so I think we need to speak a bit to the violence, because the violence in this country has been consistently and repeatedly directed against foreign nationals, and at least in terms of public violence.
Yes.
And here the tide has turned the other way. It's foreign nationals going after the police. And so we have to sort of see what we make of that. One thing to note is that the police's pretext for going in there was to confiscate counterfeit goods.
Yes,
I can personally say from having patronized many of those stores, and I'm very worried about my favorite Ethiopian restaurant, which is up there, which serves raw meat, which is delicious. You have a big plate of raw meat.
You're a braver man than I, going into the middle of town to eat raw meat in an Ethiopian restaurant.
Well, I'll tell you a story. The last time I was there, actually, I took five friends, and they were all lily white, and they were a bit nervous, and we parked the car outside and double locked it and sort of wanted to lay bricks around it and paid security guards before I was like, guys, just don't worry about it. It's going to be fine. Anyway, we went in there, and we were sort of it's on the third floor. It's densely packed, and there's lots of men putting their fingers in the raw meat. My girlfriend at the time, now fiance, got three marriage proposals. One of my other friends was there. She got five marriage proposals.
That must have been a bit of an ego boost.
It was great. The one who got five proposals was
for you.
Almost ready. I was offended. They were only willing to give me three llamas and a 4x4. But the only incident that we had on that adventure was when we were leaving. We were pulled over by the cops, and they tried to extract a bribe from us.
Yeah, that sounds like the cops.
A lot of money for no good reason. So I have seen the goods that are available there, and you can get a Springbok jersey for 250 rand, and at the airport and at Sandton it costs 600, 700, 850 rand. And so one wonders, you know, whether they are infringing upon the trademark.
Almost certainly.
And you see the Levi's shoes for 150 instead of for 250, or maybe you can bargain it down to 100. There is a concern there, and should we take, I personally, and I know you personally, we take property rights seriously.
Even intellectual property rights, which is a much more complicated issue, because, you know, how do you define who comes up with an idea? It's not as easy as, you know, who owns a piece of land or something like that, but it's still something worth taking seriously. But the difficulty I have is that when the cops went in to do this, we know what they're like from our experience of it. The Metro cops are often not very, you know, even if they're not being corrupt, which they often are, they usually are quite heavy-handed.
Yeah.
There's a lot of sort of improper stuff that goes on. So when they list the goods that they've confiscated, they often will be very vague about it, which prevents the hawkers from being able to get them back. It can be very draconian, and it can often be very violent, and people are not treated particularly nicely. So I have a lot of sympathy for people then who react very aggressively.
And not that aggressively. I mean, they were throwing stones at the vehicle. They weren't.
I mean, you can kill people like that.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
As far as I can tell from the reports, no injured police. And there were police who weren't in the vehicles. It seemed a little bit like, okay, if you get in the vehicle, then we're going to chase the vehicle away. And
yeah, you can see in the footage, the crowds are sort of, as the police go back, they fill the space in.
Yeah.
They don't run up to the Nyalas, even though they perfectly can, and sort of tip it over.
Yeah, and there's certainly no petrol bombs, so this thing doesn't seem to have been premeditated. It seems to be a response. Yeah. And why are there so many bricks on the side of the road, by the way, because there's been so much construction work on the pipes and the stuff and the streets and also, get ripped up.
Also, things as stuff isn't maintained properly, things flake off of the buildings, and then you have lots.
And
of
so this is the point that I want to get to: who maintains town? Now, I have told our listeners before. Okay, I've said it now again. I grew up in Yeovil, and one of the things about growing up in Yeovil is that I and going to the market theatre and the art galleries in town, sort of at least once a month for my entire youth, was again and again and again coming across this argument of like the CBD was once great. Okay, it was racist and terrible, but at least the infrastructure was good and it was working. And what should have happened is that it should have just gotten better and populated by all kinds of people, and instead it went to hell in a handbasket, and now we need to revive it. And talks about reviving town emerged since I can remember, 6 years old, 1996.
And many have tried.
And big business, Blue IQ, government enterprises, public-private collaborations, and there have been moments of progress, and I must say that the Market Theatre Newtown District has always been pretty good. Mabaneng is a sort of little fringe thing that's emerged in the corner.
My experience
came from Arts of Maine, and now it's collapsing a little bit.
Yeah,
in
my
itself.
Experience is that it's going a bit backwards in the sense
But Mabaneng is really on the fringe. I'm talking about town. Yeah. And in town, attempts have been made, and they failed. Again and again. I mean, to the point, sort of anecdote, Johannesburg Art Gallery is kind of in the center of it all, and it's flooded for three times as the biggest art gallery in Africa. It's crazy. You can't even protect the sort of very well-established architecture with Picassos and Cezannes and Manets.
What's the state of Ponte right now?
Ponte's not too bad. It's well secured. The last time I spoke to a resident of Ponte, there was this kind of Guinness glass thing with Ponte where it was sort of black for the first 80% and the top two, the sort of elite stories, the former penthouses had been converted into smaller things, and they were all populated by white. And
now that's some special about it.
Yeah, no, dude, it was so blatant. I lived there, and I was happy to live there, and the sense of community was great. I mean, no one held anything against anyone. I think once you were inside, going up and down the elevators, lots of little kids, people happy to have conversations, and it was very family oriented.
A success story, isn't it? Because it was in a very bad state.
Full on success story, and the foam of it was journalists and interior designers, and they've all moved out, and they've been replaced by young professionals who go work in the banks in town. It's a good success story, but it's an isolated success story. The big success story, in my opinion, and I came across this when I was doing research on foreign nationals in 2016, the first kind of work I did for the Institute of Race Relations with Rian Malan, who is really heading that project to figure out how come the foreigners do better. And most people, if you ask them why do the foreigners do better, they say it's because they're selling drugs, or it's because they come with mafia connections, or they're stealing the stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there are all these like kind of nefarious suspicions.
We've seen them time and time again against many minorities.
Yeah,
and I'd recommend Thomas Sowell on the middleman minority if you're interested in this kind of topic.
But what did we find? We found that all of the foreigners that we were speaking to were heavily conservative or religious in one way or another, Islamic or Coptic Christian from Ethiopia and Somalia, and so didn't drink. They had very low overheads. They'd sleep in their shops. They would basically win on the margins. They'd be like, if we're going to extract less money out of the business than any of our competitors, okay, we're going to live more miserable, frugal lives, then we're going to be able to charge slightly cheaper rates, and then we're going to be able to beat them on the pure business grounds of being able to offer the same product at a better rate to the customer, and the customer's going to like it. And we found this in curtains. We found this in wedding dresses. We found this in sort of consumable, fast-moving consumer goods, like, you know,
it's a very familiar tale if one looks at sort of the history of Jews in America or Indians in South Africa.
It's a tale as old as time, and that's really what we found. And we were looking hard, and we were going through Soweto, going through the CBD, finding locals who felt like they'd been hard done by. Well, can you tell us a story? Tell us about one that's doing some shady business here or there. We tried to follow those things down. Every time it turned out to be nonsense, and there were very few that even turned out to have something like that. You say, oh, the foreigners are doing this. Oh, tell us an example. I don't have an example. Anyway, I try to get a bit of a more macro picture, because I noticed that there were a lot of buildings that were looking cleaner than I'd seen them before. And that looked, and then as soon as we went inside, we were taken inside, you know, the door handles were there, the light fixtures were in, the faucets, you opened it and the water would come out. And most important common element, security guards at the entrance.
Yeah.
fingerprint ID or ID books and permanent, you know, hard material to stop people from getting in. So it kind of looks like a student res building, but it's for grown-ups who want to go to work. And so I tracked down the title. I tracked down the what do you call it, the earth numbers of about 20 to 30 properties in the sort of little Addis region. And I found 24 properties that had been sold for between 250,000 rand and 1.5 million rand between, let's say, 1994 and 2004, and that had been resold in the last decade between 2009 and 2019, actually it was 2009 to 2016, for between 15 and 115 million rand.
Those, wow, that's a lot of...
That's a big uptake, hey?
Yeah, yeah.
That's real value being created. I mean, if you add it up across all of those hundreds of millions, approaching a billion rand.
Yeah, that's spectacular.
And all of those buildings that I could track down the owners of were buildings that had been built, had been repurposed by foreign nationals. So who tried to reinvigorate town? Local business, local government, and yes, like they just didn't come right.
Yeah, the foreigners who...
Foreigners, desperate, hardworking foreigners.
So Mashaba sees as the books. Enemy.
Yes, and you know, it is against the law, some of the stuff that I saw. People making curtains and people making wedding dresses, and you ask them what their wages are, and they're below minimum wage. And you ask them, like, well, why are you doing this? And like, go to Mogadishu and you'll see why I'm doing this. And the people I'm talking about who are, you know, who sleep in their shops or sleep just behind the shop and barely eat to keep the business growing. You ask them, why would you ever succumb to this? And they say, well, try out a little visit to the Badlands south of Addis.
In South Africa, you're probably not going to be kidnapped. You're probably not going to suffer a famine, even if life is a little bit tough sometimes.
And if the cops do arrest you, there's a big chance that you can bribe your way out of it. Or if you're going to go to jail, you're going to sit in jail for a little while and then be deported, or you're going to be able to come back. Whereas if you're in the DRC or Ethiopia or Somalia or parts of Nigeria, if you get arrested, you're going to be tortured. You're going to have your fingernails pulled out. You're going to have your lists of your family's names read out to you. And like, if you don't tell on someone else, well, we're going to find them too.
Your children might get recruited into an army.
We just live in a different kind of country.
Yeah.
And a lot of these people are prepared to take every opportunity that they can to get ahead. And the bulk of it that I've come across and that Rian came across with me really was good, honest business, adding value to South Africans' lives and creating employment, and some of that employment actually going to South Africans. So, a little bit of copyright theft, that's for sure. If you've streamed Game of Thrones without paying for an HBO account recently, then I suppose we can have a conversation without any sense of hypocrisy.
Or if you've, downloaded some video games recently that you didn't perhaps pay full legal tender for.
Yeah. But, I don't know. I must say...
It does seem like a strange prioritization.
Yeah.
It's really... I mean, there's a lot of things that are tearing down the CBD, and I'm not sure if... the counterfeit Levi's are really the source of the problem.
And so, and this speaks to a bigger issue. I mean, one of the things that our listeners will be familiar with is that we usually do kind of speak about foreign countries. And here we are speaking about foreigners, but in our country. So I suppose this is one way to bring it home. But why is it? You know, there is something very peculiar about South Africa. Because in my view, and I think there is some survey data to back this up, we are in one of the most xenophobic countries in the world. In fact, I found like a South African Migration Project survey from about a decade ago that literally, I think they were citing a Pew or YouGov survey that found South Africa to be the most xenophobic country in the world on the basis of popular opinion.
I've seen a survey, I can't remember the exact number, but there was a majority of South Africans believe that we had our unemployment due to too many foreigners taking all the jobs.
So you've got massive xenophobia at a grassroots level, and at the same time, at an elite level, if you're looking at the media pages and if you're looking at what politicians say, it's generally very welcoming or puts down the issue. It's quite polite.
Yeah. I mean, Malema said that we should open our borders completely.
And we want one currency across the continent, and we really love the AU. And in fact, we love other African countries so much that when Omar al-Bashir comes here, we want to protect him from the devilish International Criminal Court.
Actually, I believe that my father, as a chapter of one of Jack Bloom's books, wrote about how, this is during the Mbeki era, how the Africanist ideology of Mbeki had not penetrated society in any real way. and he was referring, I think that was written around the time of the first big xenophobic attacks.
Yeah.
And it is true that Pan-Africanism has actually, in a meaningful sense, in a sort of negative sense of being against the West, I think that it's got some real purchase. Yeah. But in a sense of being with Africa, it has very little currency.
It outside, I mean, yes, you go to a cocktail party in Parkview or watch the sunset from Westcliff and you'll find a lot of Pan-Africanists. But yeah, outside of that, it really hasn't gotten traction. And in a way, I've considered it for a long time to be a sort of relief that the elite are so committed to a view that is anti-xenophobia on the basis of, well, if they're black, then they do count as us. But that was years ago, and now things just are a bit different. Now Pan-Africanism, as it's held up by the elite, basically equates to white people don't belong here. Zinzi Mandela sitting in Copenhagen telling us that we're all congenital rapists and land thieves, and she's far from the only one. There's government policy basically that is whose genesis is the thought that white people don't deserve to own land, that any person who owns land doesn't deserve to be here. So that's had major negative consequences. And at the same time, in terms of our attitudes to foreign nationals, we haven't done what we need to do, which is to regulate the border, allow legitimate refugees to come in, allow
a lot of this is about perceptions, right? It's about if people perceive that they control their country. It doesn't matter necessarily how many people are coming into the country. What matters is whether people feel like they can go and vote or they can go and complain, and that number will change.
Yeah,
because right now there is no control over our borders. There is a sort of distinct – it's part of this entire disintegration of the state that we've been going on about recently, is that the police really – I mean, I said this on the Daily Fringe show earlier today, and I'm questioning the wisdom of it. I'll say it again. I've crossed the border illegally to Zimbabwe specifically for the purpose of demonstrating how easy it is to cross the border illegally.
I'm topping up your whiskey glass for that.
Thank you, sir.
Well done, young man. Breaking the law and then telling the world about it.
Very good. Well, I mean, you know.
He used to be a politician, ladies and gentlemen.
Exactly. It came with the territory. But the important thing is that when people feel like they have that loss of control, that's when they start to think that they have to take matters into their own hands. It's the same with that when the police don't seem to be dealing with any kind of with other crimes. Mm. People tend to get kind of violent and start burning people alive in the streets and that kind of thing.
And so my sense is that we're living in the worst of both worlds. We've got an idea about Pan-Africanism that does violence to the constitution, that does violence to so many South African citizens, and that's really corroding the economy, unemployment numbers up, capital flight, 450 billion rands worth of private household wealth wiped off the planet last year. The rest, what's still left, is trying to flee overseas. And we have this idea of lackadaisical mismanagement as a result of the same Pan-Africanism that makes ordinary South Africans feel totally disempowered and the most frustrated of those. And there's only going to be more frustration because of the economic collapse, taking matters into their own hands. And then a police force that, rather than address the 10 violent protests that we have every day on average in this country, rather than address the world record levels of
bribes.
Yeah. Yeah. And then that irritates people, and so then they fight back. And this really does – I feel like I'm living in history. Maybe it's a bizarre thing to say, but this is perhaps what it looks like when a country falls apart.
If I may recommend to our listeners that you go and check out our episode on the Treaty of Versailles and pan-nationalism. I think we spoke specifically about Slavic nationalism, but we went through a little bit about how overseas these kind of grand racial nationalist ideas have really been a bit of a disaster.
Yeah. And if I can make another recommendation, Kwame Anthony Appiah is, in my opinion, the lead philosopher of race, and he makes the argument in his book, The Lies That Bind, that Pan-Africanism is really the ideology that's keeping race in international politics alive the most.
I think that that's pretty clearly the case. So check those out. Now, let's move on to something perhaps a little bit lighter than the imminent collapse of our beloved country, which is, cheers to that. Which is Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Mm.
as one of his opponents described him, the honorable member for the 18th century.
Yes, well.
So for those who don't know, Jacob Rees-Mogg is a famous Brexiteer conservative MP in the United Kingdom, and he has just been chosen by Boris Johnson to be the leader of the House of Commons.
Yeah, so what does the leader of the House of Commons do, actually?
I think he runs the procedure. I'm not super up to date on this. We should get Herman to tell us this because I'm sure he knows. But
Herman, just by the way, is our very Afrikaans but extremely British newest member of the Institute of Race.
He is, I believe, I think he sort of orders the legislative agenda of the House, and he represents the ruling, the leading party, and he sets sort of the standard of parliamentary procedure.
Yeah.
About, you know, what the, for example, one of the things he's in charge of is the style guide of how you're supposed
to write. So this is amazing. So he rewrites the style guide and says that there are, he's banning words, ladies and gentlemen. This guy, is he not banning words like if you say the word, you're going to get shot and imprisoned, like we do in South Africa, like you say a word, then you go to jail?
But honorable members are not supposed to use these within the House, particularly in writing.
Yes.
Such as, I think, lot is one, a lot of is
you're
one
not allowed to say a lot of. You're not allowed to say got. You're not allowed to say very much. And my favorite is you're not allowed to say hopefully. And you're not allowed to say, we understand your concerns. Because can you just imagine if politicians weren't allowed to say, hopefully, and we understand your concerns? I think that the world really would be a better place.
We'd lose half of all political speeches or answers to questions.
Yeah, I mean, if he did it in this country, if in this country you banned, like, categorically and...
If you banned the word revolutionary in this country, parliamentarians would cut their speeches in half.
Yeah. And transformation.
Yes.
If you had to, like, that weasel word that can mean so many things. If you had to replace transformation with, like, okay, if you want to say transformation, I mean, a friend of mine was saying, maybe this is a really good idea because although politicians are wont and always have been and always will be wont to just try and say nothing and fill the space but say it in a likable way, then they'll find ways around it. Okay, if you can't say hopefully, they'll say...
You see, it's
a hard one.
It's a difficult one, yeah.
And it forces them to think, what are they really going for here?
One of some of the other delightful things that he's added is that in writing, male MPs who do not have a title must be referred to with Esquire.
Yes.
As part of the descriptions of them in the text.
Which is, I mean, it's kind of silly, but it's like, it's the thing about it is that the British Parliament is so silly. There's something that I think is fantastic about...
How dare you say that about the mother of parliaments?
No, but it is. I mean, just before the show, we were watching some of Jacob Rees-Mogg's antics in the parliament and some of John Burkhouse's, the Speaker of Parliament, to kind of protect the rules of parliament as it's going. And yeah, we all know what that's like in our parliament, but in theirs, you might have seen on YouTube, he's famous for saying, order, 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 which is supposed to mean order, but he's sort of almost turned it into...
So British,
parrot music thing, he and Jacob Rees-Mogg got in a fight about the etymology of the word archaic, and they
it really is like something out of another world. And famously, British Parliament has run on a lot of cocaine. Apparently, I can't remember the exact source of this, but they tested the bathrooms, and every single surface had cocaine on it.
I can totally believe it. It's a bunch of fops who sort of went to Eton or other Ponzi schools, and they go there and they sort of try and show off who knows the most about what. And sometimes it's very substantive, but there's a lot of ad hominem. And when it's ad hominem attacks, it's quite clever. And then, of course, it's not all Eton. There's the Scottish element, and they come in there and they say, you know, what are you talking about with your understanding of what it is to be a common man?
And then there's a sort of Yorkshireman Labour members from the north of the country, real working class fellows, who will also bring a completely different vibe to the place.
And the Irish from the north of Ireland, it really is, it's profoundly theatrical.
But on top of that, I do think that despite the theatricality, there's actually way more substance than most legislatures in the world. I can't say for sure, but I can say that at least in the English-speaking world, the British Parliament is one of the healthiest of the legislatures in terms of that you can really ask difficult questions and get proper answers in response to them. Mm. Prime Minister's questions is one of the most harrowing, unfair, brutal things I've seen political leaders go through. And it's brilliant.
Yeah.
Because you stand up there and the opposition can ask you anything and you just have to be prepared to answer it and not ruin everything for yourself. And it can be really difficult because you don't know what's coming, which means that you can very easily say something you don't mean or that you will be wrong on something.
Yeah. And so to contrast it, like our parliament is super theatrical too. You've got one party that only wears like suits and ties, and you've got another party that wears sort of lots of things on their heads, and then you've got another party that wears red,
only when they know the cameras are going to be on them.
And when they know the cameras are going to be on, then the EFF come and they sing and they dance and pay back the money, get kicked out. Pay back the money, get kicked out. There's no substance. It's not very surprising. Everyone knows what's coming. So it's theater, but it's theater a little bit like...
It's a very boring show.
Yes, it's, man. It's just so predictable. And it's really intellectually very...
And also it's often flat. Rather than sort of... quips about each other's histories and plays on words and all sorts of intricate little inner jokes. A lot of it is just you're stupid and you're fat, basically.
Basically. And one way that you can tell that there's something different going on in the British Parliament is that you'll see the leader of the you'll often see someone standing up and asking whoever's at the dispatch box a really difficult question and sort of doing it in a funny way, humiliating them with a funny little barb, and everyone laughs on their side and there's a few jeers from the other side, and the other person stands up, and if they've got a really good riposte, if they can turn that joke on its head, as Jacob Rees-Mogg is able to do, you'll see the first person who made the joke laughing as well.
Yes.
You'll see him laughing at himself. It is a much more jovial atmosphere. Or her own expense. And you do not see that in South African
Parliament.
You
really don't. We don't have the same sense of humor.
At the land panel conventions that I went to, I never saw anything like it. Oh, my God.
It was so miserable.
Miserable, sad, bitter, sour, dry, flat, and often... not particularly well informed.
There are still shenanigans that go on in our parliament. Yeah. Like, for example, sometimes when the House is very low members, the opposition, usually by the opposition, I mean only the DA, the other parties don't seem to be adept enough to do this, will try to sink the passing of a bill by preventing there from being quorum. So if they realize that there's very few ANC members, they'll all slip out of the House, leave the four members required for a division, and then... just as the vote comes for a call, they'll call for a division, at which point there's not quorum in the House, so they have to start calling MPs. Now, if the MPs aren't in the room in 4 minutes, they then have to collapse Parliament. They can't pass the bill. They can't vote on it. Mm. So what the DA MPs have done on occasion, I believe, is make it so that the lifts have to stop on every floor.
Dude, like little kids in that Home Alone movie.
So that the ANC MPs in their offices, when they hear the bells, can't rush down fast enough to Parliament to come and vote on the bill. And it's something that parliamentary reporters completely miss. I only know about it because I'm related to MPs.
Yeah.
But it's so there is a little bit of sort of cunning and naughtiness that goes on in our parliament.
Which is fantastic. You've got to know the rules of the game, and you've got to play according to the rules of the game. And the best that you can possibly do, as you say, is hold a fire to those in power, ask really hard questions, surprise them, get them to trip over their own words. That's a fabulous thing to do, because then you get a real insight into what's going on. And that theatricality, two things about that theatricality that really resound for me. The one is this movie that I'm sure many people will be familiar with, about Winston Churchill. It's called The Darkest Hour. If you really want a good insight into that, I recommend that you read Boris Johnson's book, Churchill, The X Factor. I think it's a lucidly well-written history. It's a little bit polemic in some senses. But what the movie portrays, and that I think a lot of people will know, is that same stage and the same theatricality. And the story that the narrative that the movie portrays, and one that I think really has proper historical substance beyond just Johnson's analysis, is that theater saved the world. Winston Churchill's ability to command a stage, to make a good speech, to make a rousing speech, to humiliate his enemies, to lampoon the cowardice, to denigrate the appeasers, and to speak to the primal urgent need that is really in every human heart to live a liberal life, to respect the individual, and to stand up against tyranny.
Yes.
Good Lord. It was theatre that won the British Parliament. It was theatre that made the British Parliament sort of change its won the Labour MPs and enough of the Conservatives over to stand up to the Halifax faction.
That's what people forget about Churchill. They sort of look back on the war now, people who know a little bit about history, and they say, oh, well, you know, Britain actually really couldn't lose the war because of X, Y, and Z, and their economy was this and that. But what people forget is that in the moment, you don't have all the information that we in the future have available to you.
Yeah.
And so even though the British were in a stronger position than they thought, they were terrified, and there were real attempts to surrender, to basically agree with the Nazis and say, look, as long as you leave Britain alone,
yeah,
you can have Europe.
You can have Europe, we'll have us. And the thing is,
and Churchill turned that around.
And the distinction between the elite, just as we have here, the elite think one thing and the ordinary folks think another thing. A lot of what Churchill was doing was convincing the elite, was changing that sort of the worries and the cautiousness and the appeasement that had taken hold amongst the elite of the British political schema, and by persuasion, by this magic of just human talk, get them to change their minds.
Lift their spirits.
And I think that's a great thing. And I think it's okay. So Jacob Rees-Mogg is certainly no Churchill, and I don't think that he would. I think he'd consider himself much more to be. He'd consider Churchill to be a bit modern for his liking in terms of inspiration. He wrote a book about the last book. I saw him do an interview. He wrote a book about British leaders in the 19th century. And here's something that I'm just going to embarrass you.
Oh yes.
And it's going to embarrass me. And I'm assuming it's going to embarrass all our listeners. He writes one of the chapters, each chapter is about a different great British leader of the 18th and 19th century, including the one who was British Prime Minister when the UK abolished slavery, the first and only great power to do so unilaterally against its own fiscal and political interests. Who is that Prime Minister's name?
You are correct. I am embarrassed. I do not know.
If any of our listeners know, feel free to email Nicholas that he is a dweeb and that Gabriel is a fool. And if you don't know, think about that. Think about what that means, that none of us even know the Prime Minister who was in charge of the country when it abolished slavery.
Who was it, by the way? Do you know?
I don't know.
I thought you knew.
I forgot. It's the whiskey. It's Friday.
Yeah,
and I just watched that video.
Fair enough.
No
idea. May I also recommend, I haven't read it myself yet, but I've had recommended to me Andrew Robertson's biography of Winston Churchill.
That's a proper the Boris Johnson one, just to give a small qualification, what makes the Boris Johnson one amazing is the lyricism of the prose. Boris Johnson is this like fan of Greek poetry and Latin understandings of the form of rhyme and cadence, and he's a storyteller. I mean, he started his political life as a journalist who couldn't flip and stick to the facts because he was so interested in kind of moving people's emotions. And in a way, he met his match in Winston Churchill, who he knows to be a greater storyteller. Winston Churchill's first great story is really coming out of the Boer War in South Africa, which he probably
as a journalist
only got access to because his mother...
Don't get any ideas, Gabriel.
...slept with... had been widowed. Winston Churchill's father had been a great politician himself, although quite a quiet conservative guy. Then when the mother was a widow, she romanced a general, and then the general was like, well, let's give the boy the best opportunity he can. And so he did a little bit of fighting in Somalia, and there Khartoum near there, sort of trying to trace down Lord Gordon, who'd been the great British hero. A movie was sort of made about him called
Was that the Four Feathers?
No. The one where the guy says, where Laurence Olivier says, it's Laurence Olivier says, I like the desert because it's clean.
Well, that's a good line.
Anyway, Churchill was there, and he was shooting bullets as the Mahdists, the sort of early ISIS of the late 19th century, were trying to create ISIS in Sudan. And then he came down to the Boer War to be a war correspondent. And there, I think he was probably pretty honest, although I think he probably told a bit of porcupines lies. And then, anyway, Boris Johnson sees in Churchill a great storyteller.
Well, and because he sees himself, I think.
Because he sees himself, but also it really does bring out the humility in him, which is not something you see a hell of a lot of all of the time out of Johnson. But he's at his most humble, kind of trying to match his own sort of three-quarters abilities at storytelling to Winston Churchill's 200% storytelling abilities.
Yeah, very well said.
It's a good book.
Anyway, so let's move on to the last delightful topic of the day, which is something I'm very eager to talk about. So we'll just go over this briefly because we're already at sort of 47 minutes or so. But
this doesn't need time. This just needs
intensity. Yes. Marianne Williamson.
Oh.
She is left-wing America's answer to Trump in a very real sense. Mm. She is outside the establishment. She's never been a politician before, except when she unsuccessfully ran as an independent for a California congressional seat. She is famous as a sort of self-help speaker and spiritual guru of a kind of new age variety. She was very influential in Hollywood during the outbreak, the first outbreak in America of HIV/AIDS,
yeah.
where she kind of provided spiritual and psychological comfort to celebrities who were tortured by the fear of AIDS and believing that it might rip down their communities there.
Yeah.
If you look her up, she's been to sort of weddings with every celebrity you can think of in your life, places, weddings where Michael Jackson was the best man and she was the officiator of the ceremony and that kind of thing.
Reminds one a little bit of Donald Trump going to Hillary Clinton's wedding.
Yes, it's very similar. She's also being supported by conservatives who think she's just really funny.
So just to be clear, the conservatives think she's funny, but really they think that she is such a ridiculous idea, that she's such a joke, that no one would ever get behind her. So if they can just push her up the ranks,
then Donald Trump will beat her for sure.
Yeah. Have we heard that argument before?
We've heard that argument before. She's polling quite low in the polls right now. I think she's kind of around 1%, and she might not qualify for the next debate yet, although there's still time for that to happen. And she's had some pretty good performances because she said things, she had these memorable quotes, like, "We're going to defeat Donald Trump with the power of love."
No, but say, what is the problem? Donald Trump rose to power on a
dark psychic wave of hate, and we're going to defeat him with love.
Oh, man, you can put that in a bottle. It's lightning.
It is. She actually is a much better politician than a lot of people give her credit for.
Yeah.
I mean, she's made her entire career basically by just talking to people and making them feel good about herself.
Who's her favorite? Who's her big champion? Oprah Winfrey.
Oprah Winfrey, after the last debate, said, "Marianne, wow, that was amazing." Now, people underestimate, so these are not the most politically engaged people in the world, but people who watch Oprah make up a very significant chunk of the electorate of the United States.
And they're passionate, and they are influential.
Yes.
One of the things Malcolm Gladwell likes to speak about is the influencers. The influencers nowadays means like some guy who's got 12 people following him on Facebook, like you or me.
On Instagram.
Yeah. But there are influencers as in sort of, you know, that matriarch that hosts the society event that once a year or twice a year you get dragged along to because this is just like the important thing to go to and there's lots of important people there and then that person says this and says that and it's very nice. And then they say something like, "Well, that Marianne Williamson, isn't she lovely?" And then the gentlemen and the ladies in the room sort of take heed and they start wondering whether you should take this kind of person seriously. This is the kind of fan base that Trump tapped into in a way.
Yes.
The patriarchy.
The sort of right-wing version of it, yes.
Hmm.
Now, just to be clear, Marianne Williamson is completely insane.
Once again, there is some resemblance.
Yes, there is definitely some resemblance. She sort of has talked about in the past that the voice you hear inside yourself is the voice of Jesus, which, you know, some religious scholars may differ on.
Mm.
She's talked about overcoming diseases through meditation and that diseases are more driven by your mental state rather than physical ailments.
No, she doesn't think diseases exist in the first place. And in this regard, she thinks that they're a figment of someone else's imagination.
I was saying it very positively.
Yeah, you're being so sweet, man. Let me just tell you, because Sitle asked me to look into something. But Black Centric Forum, just quickly to bring it back home, they're these guys who tomorrow are going to be having a big shoot up in some shooting range in Joburg in order to get only blacks people. They say blacks only are invited and white monopoly capital is coming to kill you, so you must come learn how to shoot them and how to do the grassroots revolution. So I Googled them to figure out who they are, and on their Twitter page I found that they also think that disease, HIV in particular, is a figment of only white people's imagination that has somehow managed to poison the black souls of souls of black people and make them sick. And all you really need to do is proper black consciousness and then you won't be sick in the first place.
So Marianne's signature campaign issue was she launched, I think, with saying that there needed to be, I think, $10,000, I can't remember the exact amount, in reparations to black Americans, just a straight up check. She also, at one of the beginning of her
In campaign, which case, I'd like to point out that I'm a black American.
Yes.
And $10,000 is exactly the amount that I'd like, at least.
She also started one of her speeches and rallies I mean, she doesn't have huge rallies yet, but she had one of her speeches with telling every white member of the audience to find the nearest black person and apologize to them.
Immediately. And last year, just to say about her rallies, last year she did do a Love America tour.
Yes.
Where she toured the entire country and did draw pretty substantial kind of grassroots support.
She's also a multiple New York Times bestseller. I think she's written 4 New York Times bestselling books.
And a lot of them have been featured on the old Oprah Winfrey favorites book club list.
So a surprisingly influential person, and with some breakout debate performances as being at least very memorable.
Mm.
Let's see where this goes. It's very possible that she could sneak through to the next debate, in which case, who knows where we go from there.
Who knows where we go from there. And, what does it look like? It's like New York is a big city. It's a lot of different things. But there's a kind of side of New York that's that New Yorker guy who's like, hey, get out of my way, full of elbows,
I'm walking
teeth.
Here.
I'm walking here. Better. You know, I need to swear to actually do justice to this, but I suppose we're allowed to drink whiskey and profess crimes, but not swear.
Well, we probably could swear, but let's not do it yet, because I haven't worked out how to flag us as explicit.
It's complicated. But this is so that Trump was like kind of the New Yorker answer to this Washington establishmentarian kind of bi-coastal
kind
elite.
Kind of vulgar.
This vulgar, brash real estate guy who knows everyone.
And he does
knows
deals.
Everyone.
Big deals.
I do deals.
Huge deals.
Hugest deals you've ever seen, bigger than the buildings even, is the deal. And now we have the other side, Los Angeles.
California's answer.
Hollywood, chilled, beauty, love. Take it easy, man. Just, you know, get with the vibes and push away the darkness with your mind of the disease and the cancer in your liver. Just push it away. And this is how we're going to push away Trump. Just by thinking about beautiful halos descending around our chakras that are rainbow colored, just like the flag should be, and kill Donald Trump. With love.
With love.
Kill Donald Trump.
So my advice to the listeners is, if Marianne Williamson gets elected or if she makes it through to the next debate, I think you should speak to your financial advisor about buying gold.
Unofficial slogan of Two Crickets and a Thorn Tree is probably buy gold. I don't have any money. First thing to do is get some money.
Yes. The other thing I would like to point out is that I think at this stage in the primaries, Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter were roughly slightly, maybe 0.5% ahead in the polls of where Marianne Williamson is right now. Food for thought. On that note, on the power of love, I think we're going to conclude today. So if you like this podcast and you would like to donate to the Institute and support our work, you can SMS your name to 32823. And we'll catch you on the next episode of Two Crickets in a Thorn Tree. Thanks, everyone.